Previously on Beta.
Welcome to Fright Night. For real.
What's the matter, kid? Don't you like clowns? Why? Hey. Don't we make you laugh?
Groovy.
Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome to a very scary Beta Halloween from Wisconsin Public Radio. As Alfred Hitchcock would say,
today we venture deep into our dank and desiccated chamber of horrors to revisit some of our most horrifying and gut-wrenchingly monstrous moments.
Like our cobweb-tinged conversation with Don Coscarelli, director of the 1979 horror cult classic, Phantasm. It is still scary after all these years.
You know, as I was making the movie, I started to not worry so much about whether the audience was comprehending what I was doing exactly. And that's a risky thing to do. Thank God it worked out.
And author Robin Means Coleman on the history of black horror movies.
He's not killed by zombies. He's killed by the police. He's killed by sheriffs. And in the case of Night of the Living Dead, these were real officers who were cast in the film.
But first, Joe Hill. He's the New York Times best-selling author of The Fireman and Nosferatu and the comic book series Lock and Key. And like his father, novelist Stephen King, Joe often sees his work adapted into TV shows and films. For example, Nosferatu on AMC and Lock and Key on Netflix. Joe's short story collection, Full Throttle, features Joe collaborating with his father on two of the stories. It's no surprise that movies are a big influence on Joe's work. In the introduction to Full Throttle, Joe talks about one of his favorite films, the 1971 made-for-TV movie, Duel.
I love that movie. It was the breakthrough film for an incandescent young talent. You know, Steven Spielberg was 21 when he made it. He had great source material. Duel was based on a novella by Richard Matheson, who is sort of the grandfather of modern American horror. In some ways, he was Stephen King before there was a Stephen King.
Yeah.
Matheson wrote The Incredible Shrinking Man. He wrote I Am Legend, which has been, I think, filmed three different times. Duel was a novella he wrote in the early 1970s, and it's about an everyman on the run from a faceless truck driver who's persecuting him for unknown reasons. And it was made into a terrific picture.
Operator.
I'd like to report a truck driver that's been endangering my life.
In that case, I'll have to give you the police, sir.
Right, well, give me the police.
Sir, which department do you want?
Whichever's closer.
What number are you calling from?
This number is 9821.
You were only 10 years old the first time you saw Duel. What did you think of it?
I loved it. You know, it inserted itself into my fantasy life. My dad and I would go for drives, and when we were out for drives, we'd pretend the truck was after us. We'd talk it through, you know, about what we'd do and where we'd go, and, the, you know, imagine the truck rearing up to slam the back end of our car. And I did a lot of screaming and stuff, you know, acting my part.
Okay, you want to play games?
So in Full Throttle in the collection, there are two stories in the book. There's 13 stories in all, but I wrote two of them with my dad, and one of them is Throttle. It is a kind of reinvention of Matheson's Duel. That's a story about an outlaw motorcycle gang on the run from a faceless trucker who wants revenge on them for unknown reasons. And in some ways, it was like, you know, it was like we started writing that story when I was 8 years old. You know, we started writing that story playing truck in the car.
Yeah. As you mentioned, the story Throttle that you co-wrote with your father, it's kind of your take on Duel. It seems to me that whereas in Duel, we never learn why the truck driver is trying to destroy Dennis Weaver's character in his car, in your story Throttle, you've included some motivation for the truck driver's homicidal tendencies. Would that be fair to say?
Yeah, ultimately, there is a revelation. There is a reveal. We find out why the trucker is after them. That sort of goes back a little bit to H.P. Lovecraft had this idea that it was important to keep the horror off screen. You know, mm-hmm. that what we didn't see was more scarier than anything the artist could show. And I think there is some truth to that. I mean, like, certainly Spielberg in Jaws, his happy discovery in the making of Jaws was that the longer we went without seeing the shark, the more frightened of it we were.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think, and this is something I sort of picked up from my dad, I do think at a certain point it's worth risking it, that the reader does deserve some revelation, some understanding of what it was all about, and that maybe the monster does have to come out from under the bed. You do have to shine a light into the back of the closet to see what's hiding there.
Yeah.
So I guess in some ways, that would sort of be one of my dad's disagreements with H.P. Lovecraft's legacy. I'm sure there are others.
I'm curious about how the process of collaborating on this story, Throttle, with your dad worked. Can you tell me a bit about how you two approached that?
Sure, I can tell you what it's like to collaborate with my dad. You ever see any of those Roadrunner cartoons?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. So basically, imagine Wile E. Coyote getting a box that says Acme on the side. And then he pulls apart the crate, and inside there's a rocket. And he lights the fuse and climbs on top. And the rocket blasts off after the Roadrunner. And Wile E. Coyote is hanging on top, barely clinging on for dear life. I've written with my dad on two short stories, and both times I felt like Wile E. Coyote hanging onto the rocket.
That's a great analogy. So a book of short stories can't have the same kind of flow that a novel can, but I'm thinking you must have given a lot of thought to the sequencing of the stories in Full Throttle. How did you decide the running order of the stories?
I don't know how much strategy went into it, but you do look for some kind of coherent flow.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in a way, it's sort of like trying to put together an LP. You want one song to flow naturally into the next. I know that the first story in the book is Throttle, and that the second story in the book is called Dark Carousel. It's set in the early 1990s, and it's about four teenagers who deface a carousel, a big 19th century carousel, and then there are supernatural consequences. So Throttle was the first time I ever collaborated with my dad. And Dark Carousel is almost like a cover of a Stephen King story. You know, it's like the most Stephen King thing I've ever written.
Let's listen to a bit of Nate Cordry's reading of Dark Carousel.
The Wurlitzer began to play. A theatrical, whimsical, but also curiously dirge-like melody. Wandering amid the steeds, I looked at the creatures of the wheel with a mix of fascination and repulsion. It seemed to me a uniquely disquieting collection of grotesqueries. There was a wolf as big as a bicycle, its sculpted glossy fur a tangled mess of blacks and grays, and its eyes as yellow as my beer. One paw was lifted slightly, and its pad was crimson, as if he had trod in blood. A sea serpent uncoiled itself across the outer edge of the carousel, a scaly rope as thick as a tree trunk. It had a shaggy gold mane and a gaping red mouth lined with black fangs. When I leaned in close, I discovered they were real. A mismatched set of shark's teeth, black with age. I walked through a team of white horses, frozen in the act of lunging, tendons straining in their necks, their mouths open as if to scream in anguish or rage. White horses with white eyes, like classical statuary.
So I wrote Wolverton Station in a notebook while I was on tour for my second novel, Horns, in the United Kingdom. All the travel was done by British Rail. So I wound up taking British trains from London to Edinburgh and back with stops at Liverpool and Glasgow and, you know, here and there around the country. The first day on the train, we flickered through a station and I only half caught the name of it. And I believe the name of the station was Wolverhampton. But, you know, I saw it out of the corner of my eye and I thought it said Wolverton Station. And I thought, boy, what would you meet? Who would you meet if you got off the train in Wolverton Station? And instantly, you know, I mean, I'm a guy who grew up watching films like American Werewolf in London, you know. Yes. So I hear Wolverton Station and I immediately imagine a sleepy little British hamlet entirely populated by werewolves. And I thought that was such a fun little idea that I started writing it straight away. And I think I started writing it on my first day on the British trains and finished the story on the last day on the trains just as the tour was winding up. So that was a really happy writing experience.
Mm-hmm. And it's a really happy reading experience, too.
Oh, thank you.
The wolf's snout shriveled, and his black lips wrinkled to show the hooked rows of his teeth. He yawned, and a surprisingly bright red tongue lolled from the opening. And if there had been any doubt in Saunders's mind, there hadn't been really. That was all for it. In the next moment, he fought with himself, a desperate, terrible struggle, not to issue a soft sob of fear. It was like fighting a sneeze. Sometimes you could hold it in, sometimes you couldn't. Saunders held it in.
Are you an American?
Asked the wolf.
Don't answer, don't talk,
Saunders thought, in a voice he didn't recognize. It was the shrill, piping voice of panic. But then he did answer, and his tone was his own, level and certain. He even heard himself laugh.
Ha, got me. Excuse, do you mind if I use the bathroom?
As he spoke, he half rose to his feet. He and the wolf were in chairs that faced a spotted formica table, and he couldn't quite stand up all the way.
That, of course, was Neil Gaiman reading an excerpt from Wolverton Station. Another story that you wrote with your father is In the Tall Grass, and this one kind of struck me as Lovecraftian cosmic horror, sort of crossed with a bit of a Children of the Corn vibe in terms of setting. Is that what you and your dad were going for there?
I don't know what we were going for exactly. You know, we were both in Florida. He had just finished working on something, and I had just finished working on something. And we went out to the Colonial House of Pancakes, you know, at like 10 in the evening, and we're eating flapjacks or something. And we both agreed we should write a story, and so we came up with something on the spot and wrote the whole thing in about 6-7 days. You know, here we are a few years later, and it's going to be this big Netflix film. I think the drop date is October 4th, and it's really scary, you know? I mean, what a great film. It was directed by Vincenzo Natali. I mean, this is horror for horror fans. It has a feel kind of like, a kind of relentlessly scary feel like Hereditary or It Follows. So it'll be interesting to see what people make of it.
Did Vincenzo consult with you and your dad about what he was planning on doing? Did you guys have any input into it at all?
Very much so. And, you know, he wrote the script himself, and I loved the script. You know, it was like a horror movie version of Inception that takes place in a meadow instead of in someone's head, because it does lots of tricksy things with time and space.
Can you tell us a bit about In the Tall Grass without, of course, revealing any spoilers?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, In the Tall Grass is about a brother and sister, two people traveling across country from New England to California, Becky and Cal DeMuth. They're somewhere in the heartland, and they pull over at the side of the road because Becky isn't feeling too well. She's 9 months pregnant. They get out, and there's this giant field at the side of the road. You know, the grass is like 8 feet high. It's up over their heads. And they hear a child screaming in the field.
Help! I'm lost in here!
Did you hear that?
And so they both step into the grass to try to find him. And once they enter the field, they can't find their way out either. You know, they get separated from each other. And at one point, they're shouting to each other. Becky says to Cal, let's both jump up at the same time, and I'll see where you are, and I'll head to you. And they both jump up, and they can both see each other. They're about 12 feet apart. And they fall back down. And then Becky says, let's do it again. I want to be sure of my bearings. So they jump up, only this time they're 25 feet apart. Neither of them has taken a step, but they are drifting apart in spite of themselves.
Becky?
Travis?
In some ways, the movie is actually a little bit more hopeful. It finds some hopeful notes that are unique to the film. And I think that that's a good thing.
Yeah, we all need hope.
Yeah. And not every short story can deliver hope, though. I always feel like with a novel, You know, a novel takes anywhere between 12 and 24 hours to read a whole novel. And I kind of feel like anyone who slogs along that long deserves something at the end, some kind of uplift, some reason to feel like the world is not all terrible. I mean, they stuck with me that long. I want them to have something good at the ending. The short story works by different rules. That only takes one sitting to read. And a lot of the best short stories end with a final twist of the knife. And I do like that. I do like the ugly jolt of that final twist.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, me too. I crave the ugly jolts at the end of the short story. Yes. So, Joe Hill, thank you very much.
Hey, thanks so much for talking to me, man. I had a lot of fun.
Joe Hill is the author of the short story collection Full Throttle. It features two collaborations with his father, Stephen King, the King of Horror. Find out more about Joe at WPR.org/beta. Speaking of horror, David Lynch's debut feature film, Eraserhead, is one of the most disturbing and frightening films of all time. It feels like you've suddenly been parachuted into a black and white nightmare. Christine McKenna is the co-author of David Lynch's biographical memoir, Room to Dream. Here's the excerpt from our conversation with Christine, where she talks about the unnerving power of Eraserhead.
The first time I saw Eraserhead, I didn't know what I was looking at. Most people, I think, respond that way. But it's very powerful and it's very seductive because it's so beautiful. It looks like it's on velvet or something.
Yeah.
It's a black and white film, of course. And first I was pulled in just by the beauty and the humor, because there are parts of it that are very funny. But as I became more familiar with the film, I think it's a deeply spiritual film. David says that too.
Yeah, so for those listeners who aren't familiar with Eraserhead, this is a tough question, but I know you can answer it. Can you kind of give us a brief synopsis of the film's storyline?
It's the story of Henry Spencer, who gets a girl named Mary X pregnant, and she gives birth to a deformed infant and abandons Henry with the infant, and the infant then dies. And along the way, Henry has kind of an erotic awakening with a neighbor. And through very complicated means, there's a very kind of miraculous ending, and it ends on a happy note.
Eraserhead is really, it seems, all about the mood. There's very little dialogue. The film strikes me as kind of the cinematic equivalent of a tone poem. And so much of the mood is conveyed through the soundtrack that David and Alan Splett worked so hard to create. Can you talk about the role that the soundtrack plays in Eraserhead?
Alan Splett was hugely important to David in helping him develop his ability to design sound. Alan was a real genius. They met in Philadelphia, and they kind of invented their own ways to make sound effects, because David always has such specific things, ideas in his mind when he does something. They couldn't find any recorded sound effects that matched what he needed. So he worked closely with Alan up until Blue Velvet, which Alan left because he said he couldn't work on it. It made him sick. There's a lot of like distant train whistles and barking dogs and insects, and he's very good at harvesting sound.
Yes, very much so, and marrying it so well to images.
Shortly after I started meditating, I would always do these little drawings in the food room. And one day I started drawing this little woman. And I'm drawing along, and I'm looking at this drawing, and this woman came to life in my mind. And I realized that this woman lived in Eraserhead, and that this woman lived inside the radiator.
Christine McKenna is the co-author, along with David Lynch, of Room to Dream.
Personally, I have always had a genuine fear and concern about what happens after you die, shared with probably every other member of my species.
Director Don Coscarelli joins us to talk about his indie science fiction fantasy horror film, Phantasm. That's coming up in just a moment. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta on Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Doug Gordon, and this is Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Don Coscarelli is the youngest filmmaker ever to have a feature film distributed by a major studio. He was only 19 years old when he sold his independently produced and critically acclaimed drama, Jim, the World's Greatest, to Universal Pictures. But it was Don's third film that put him on the map, an indie horror movie called Phantasm. Don wrote it, photographed it, directed it, and edited it. Phantasm was released in 1979, and it has spawned four sequels. The film is now considered a cult classic and has appeared on many critics' lists of best horror films. We spoke with Don about the lasting legacy of Phantasm and his career as an independent filmmaker.
Somebody once told me that horror films make money. It's funny because today, that's absolutely the truth, because some of the most successful films are the horror and genre films. But at any rate, I got this bug in my mind that maybe my next film, I need to do something a little more commercial. And mm-hmm. so I decided to try doing horror.
Yeah, and that was a great decision. Your third film, probably your best-known film, the 1979 horror film Phantasm, which, speaking of getting back to this idea of doing all this work, you wrote, directed, shot it, and edited it. For those of our listeners who aren't familiar with it, can you give us a brief synopsis of Phantasm without revealing too many, if any, preferably no spoilers?
Well, basically, it's a pretty simple story about a 12-year-old boy who lives with his older brother, who's a little older, about 20s, and these two brothers are recent orphans. Their parents have died, and so the younger brother is really trying to come to grips with the loss of the parents and potential loss of his brother who wants to leave. And so, he has an active imagination, but he might just be the sharpest knife in the drawer in that town. And he starts to notice some strange things going on. There's a series of murders. One of their friends is killed. There's a funeral up at this odd mortuary cemetery complex called Morningside. And our hero, Mike, witnesses some strange things and notices this strange, very enigmatic and sinister mortician.
Yeah, played by Angus Scrimm, yeah.
The funeral is about to begin, sir.
And he and his brother and their neighborhood friend, who's the ice cream vendor, played by Reggie Bannister, get involved in trying to learn what the nature is going on up here, and pretty soon it takes some really strange, frightening turns.
Mm-hmm. So where did you get the idea for Phantasm?
Well, that's a really good story. Truthfully, I had attended a few funerals in my young age, and it was just remarkable to me the way our society deals with death. Mm-hmm. I mean, personally, I have always had a genuine fear and concern about what happens after you die, shared with probably every other member of my species. this imagery that goes on and the way that we treat, because it's different in other societies, but here, there's this strange practice of men dressed in dark suits, and they're in these mausoleums, and you give them the dead body of your deceased relative, and it goes away into sort of experimentation or scientific operating lab, and then the corpse comes back looking kind of like your relative, but not exactly, mm-hmm. and, long funeral coaches, all this imagery, really good stuff, and I thought, this would be a great setting for a horror film. Combined with the fact that favorite sci-fi movie from the 50s I loved, it was called Invaders from Mars, mm-hmm. and that had a storyline where there was a kid where there was a Martian ship landed in his backyard, but nobody believed this boy when he told them that he saw it. And I thought that idea of having a kid who saw strange things, but he was the only one pretty much on his own to try to figure out the nature of it.
I was messing around up at Morningside Cemetery, and I saw something. Something really scary.
What was all in your mind?
And not really knowing it, but I ended up making a mashup of horror, fantasy, and science fiction.
Yeah. Wasn't part of the storyline of Phantasm, the Chrome Sphere, didn't the idea for that part of the story come from a dream you had when you were 15 years old? Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely true. It's maybe one of the only dreams I've remembered vividly enough to put into a film, but I'd had a dream where I was just being pursued down long corridors by this silver chrome orb. And it stuck with me. And while I was writing Phantasm, I thought, well, this would be an interesting device to try to work into the story. And so I did. And at the time, never having any idea what kind of an impact that would have, because that image of the sphere and the way that the sphere, it's a, you know, without giving away too much, it becomes a deadly killing device. And the impact of that sequence really woke audiences up.
Oh, yeah.
And a lot of people never forgot it. You know, we'll be introduced to people and they go, oh, you did Phantasm. Oh, yeah, I don't know if I know that movie. And then all I have to do is just put my hand with a couple fingers out. I go, you know, the one with the ball, like yeah. that. And they immediately remember.
Yeah, it's very appropriate. That dream inspiration is very appropriate because Phantasm, the way it plays out, like the first time I saw it, I thought, wow, this is, you know, so much like a nightmare, very surreal and very dreamlike. And I would even say that Phantasm and David Lynch's Eraserhead are two of the best cinematic representations of a nightmare that I've ever seen. Did you always know that Phantasm was going to rely heavily on dream logic, or was that something that just developed as you were writing the screenplay?
You know, first off, thank you for that praise and lumping me in with David Lynch, because, wow, am I in awe of his work. I was, you know, a little younger, a little more confident, possibly, like the young are, and I was willing to take some risks and tell this story in a different kind of style. And, you know, as I was making the movie, I started to not worry so much about whether the audience was comprehending what I was doing exactly. And that's a risky thing to do. Thank God it worked out. But I do think that by having it grounded with some real elemental scares throughout, kept audiences' attention.
You made this film in the late 1970s before CGI. So how did you achieve the special effects of the silver orb zooming around the funeral parlor?
Well, truthfully, cellophane tape and a lot of fishing line. You know, we did everything the old-fashioned way. Special effects, well, they're much like magic tricks. I mean, you have to, for a very short period of time, create an illusion that works. And if you just break it up into its component parts, a lot of times each little component is doable. Mm-hmm. It's just trying to do it all at once is where nowadays they do these effects all at once and have characters morph into other characters all through these very complicated digital effects. But for instance, with that flying sphere, we had to figure out a way to make the thing fly. And, you know, we tried a lot of exotic things with piano wire and that, none of that worked. And, you know, somebody at some point just said, well, why don't you just chuck the damn thing? Mm-hmm. And it was right on. And for that particular shot, we just had somebody throw the sphere, but we shot it in reverse and in slow motion.
Yeah.
And that created the effect. When we wanted it to round a corner, we could use fishing line and put it on a little string and have it whip around that way. So it was a function of, you know, simplifying and then just trying to figure out an innovative way of making that little small effect work.
You had a really dangerous experience while you were working on Phantasm, didn't you?
Well, I had a lot of them. You know, in my book, True Indie, I mentioned a couple. We had to do some, I shot a sequence with a car chase, and in the chase, the lead star had to pop up through the sunroom with a shotgun. And I wanted to get a close, intimate shot, so I was riding in the trunk. You know, again, being young, being ignorant, didn't know that even when you're shooting with blank charges, that they are dangerous. And there have been cases after that time, you know, where actors had actually died from being too close to the proximity of a blank pistol.
Oh, dear.
Yeah, and so anyway, so I was like 2 feet away from a shotgun loaded with blank shells, and the actor was just doing his great action hero stuff, shooting right at me with the camera. And to protect my face, we put this camera pad over my face and taped it on, figuring it with some aluminum foil, figuring if anything came out, that would protect it. And it did. It's just that all this burning stuff hit the pad and lit it on fire. And then there was this mad dash to try to pull this burning pad off my face before it torched my skin, which thank God we were able to.
Yeah, that's very fortunate, yeah. The music and the sound design in Phantasm are a big part of the film's success. Can you talk a bit about that?
Yeah, sure can. I was lucky enough on my very first film to meet a terrific composer, super talented man named Fred Myro. And Fred teamed up with a friend of his named Malcolm Seagrave, and the two of them crafted this really beautiful, insidious theme that just became the icon of Phantasm, is this little 8-note theme mm-hmm. that he created. It was so powerful and so important. What was wonderful about Fred and Malcolm also is that both of them were really unconventional composers. I mean, both of them had come up through classical music. Fred was an apprentice to Leonard Bernstein at the New York Philharmonic.
Wow.
Oh, yeah, and he'd had a Guggenheim Fellowship and all kinds of things. But he also loved to produce rock bands. So he was writing these wonderful symphonic pieces and also, you know, producing some pretty hardcore rock stuff. So when they came to approach doing Phantasm, they were really interested in working with unusual instruments. And that was really cool stuff. I mean, there's a chase scene that's completely scored to Indian tablas. One of their favorite tools, you know, in some of the really scary parts is they would take a drumstick and scrape it across a cymbal, and you'd get these weird kind of sound. And frequently they'd use that whenever the tall man was going to appear. But a lot of unconventional, out-of-the-box thinking that enhanced this soundtrack that was so important.
Here it is, 40 years since Phantasm has been released. It's become a cult classic. It often appears on critics' lists of the best horror films. Why do you think the film has struck a chord with so many people?
My opinion has evolved over the years, because one of the cool parts about working in the horror genre is that there's a very passionate fan. Some people call them cult.
Yes.
But I call them passionate. They're passionate fans. And the fans congregate at these horror conventions and very much online. So I'm constantly getting feedback as to why. So let me give you a few of the reasons why Phantasm is. I think number one is the basic theme of the movie, which is, what happens when you die? I mean, this is a universal question that everyone on this planet at one point or another thinks about. And it's a pretty strange and surreal answer to that question.
Yeah.
Number two, there's a really strong familial bond in the film that has to do with, you know, loss of the parents and being orphaned, about this tight brotherhood relationship. And they almost have a third brother in this character of Reggie, the ice cream man.
Yeah, that's
true. It's these three heroes are allied against the forces of evil. You know, it's very strong. But there's one other element to its success that I've learned about in recent years, Doug, is that I meet so many young men who are in their 30s, 40s, and 50s, and they always tell me, you know, when I saw that movie, I just never forgot it, because there was that kid, and he was shooting a shotgun, he was driving his brother's car, he was fighting the undead in a weird way, and not by any design, I created this teen male empowerment movie.
Don Coscarelli is the man behind the indie horror movie Phantasm, and the author of True Indie, Life and Death in Filmmaking. His other films include The Beastmaster and Bubba Hotep. Learn more about Don and his films at wpr.org/beta.
you go to heaven, you come to us.
Our conversation with Don got us thinking about the first horror films that scared us to death, or close to it anyway, so I figured I'd get a few people together and we'd talk about it. I'm joined now by WPR's J. Carlisle Larson and Beta Technical Director Steve Gotcher for a terrifying Beta Roundtable. JCL, let's start with you. What is the film you can remember as your earliest scare?
So this is not a horror film, but it scared the crap out of me. And I think some of it could have been situational, but Close Encounters of the Third Kind really, really freaked me out. A little background. At the time I was watching it, I was probably around 6 or 7, getting a perm in my living room. And I was trapped there because my mom was doing the perm, watching the movie. Couldn't escape, had to watch all of it, and it really freaked me out. So it could have been fumes, could have been the movie, but it was definitely terrifying. Cannot watch it to this day.
Wait a second, he's heading right for my windshield. The traffic is approaching head on. Ultra bright and really moving. And right by us, right now. That was really close.
Wow. Could have been the fumes, could have been the movie, could have been a combination.
Probably. I also lived in Nevada, which was like in the 90s was like the height of like UFO stuff. So it was also very spooked.
Wow.
So that is my horror film scare time.
All right.
Zone.
Thank you for sharing that. An unpredictable pick
do what
from
I can.
JCL. And you do a lot. And yeah, let's turn it over to
I
Steve Gotcher.
I find Richard Dreyfuss to be pretty scary.
Yeah, yeah.
I got to say.
And the mashed potatoes in the shape of, what is it? Devil's Tower?
Devil's Tower. Yep.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Steve. Your favorite?
Well, when I was a kid, around 10 years old, I lived in Los Angeles, and there was this Saturday afternoon show that featured old horror movies and science fiction movies called Strange Tales of Science Fiction. And so my cousins and I lived next door to each other, and we always got together at one or the other's house on Saturday and watched Strange Tales of Science Fiction. And one afternoon, they showed Invasion of the Body Snatchers. With Kevin McCarthy.
The original version, yes, not the Donald Sutherland remake. Right.
It was film noir, and I didn't know what film noir was. It didn't mean anything to me. But it just kind of was the kind of film that just sort of made you feel very uncomfortable. The way it was shot, the way it was, the way the dialogue went. But the final scene in the film, when Kevin's character, Miles Benelli, kisses Dana Winter, who is the character Becky, and he lifts up from her and realizes she's not who she was when he left her before, and then runs out of the cave and runs out to the freeway and is screaming,
"You're here already! You're next! You're next! You're next!"
I couldn't sleep that whole night. It was mm-hmm. terrible.
Yeah, that's a great film. Have you ever read the novel, Jack
I have
Finney?
Not.
The novel is great, too.
Those are both excellent choices. Of course you read the novel.
Of course, yeah.
Have and I you seen haven't the seen the film.
No, I've seen the original, but I haven't seen the remake.
Doug.
Oh, yeah. That'll mean it's scariest. It's kind of obvious. I wish it wasn't so obvious, but I think I have to go with it because of the impact it had when I saw it was Alfred Hitchcock's 1960 classic Psycho.
She just goes a little mad sometimes. We all go a little mad sometimes.
Based on the novel by Robert Bloch, who, of course, is from Milwaukee. Our executive producer, showrunner, Adam Friedrich's hometown. And just because I've been a Hitchcock fan for years and just the way, well, for one thing, it's one of the most iconic scores, the Bernard Herrmann score, just all strings and the famous shower scene, sting. And just the audacity that Hitchcock had to kill off Janet Leigh's character, Marion Crane, at the end of the first act, about 47 minutes into the film. A fun fact about Psycho, of course, is that Ted Knight, from Caddyshack and the Mary Tyler Moore Show, Ted Baxter appears. He's the police officer that brings the blanket to Norman at the very end. The film still holds up in my humble
Doesn't
opinion.
Doesn't he have the line, "Norman, we're waiting"?
No, he does.
Oh, wait, but, I'm getting my movies.
Yeah, yeah, and you think Gus Van Sant in that remake, that shot-for-shot remake in color with Vince Vaughn as Norman Bates?
No.
Bad idea.
No.
Okay, well, thank you, J. Carlisle Larson.
Thank you.
And thank you, Steve Gotcher.
You're welcome.
No, you're welcome. By the way, I love your Crypt Keeper costume.
But I'm not wearing a costume.
This has been a Beta Roundtable. No horror films were harmed in the making of this roundtable. Let us know what movie first freaked you out. Send us an email, beta@wpr.org.
He's not killed by zombies. He's killed by the police. He's killed by sheriffs, and in the case of Night of the Living Dead, these were real officers who were cast in the film.
Author Robin Means Coleman joins us to talk about the history of black horror movies. That's coming up in just a moment. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. This is Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. The black horror film is having a moment. The resurgence started with Jordan Peele's 2017 movie, Get Out. Peele created a critically acclaimed horror movie that tackles racism in a very enlightening way. And since then, we have seen more black horror movies and TV shows, like Peele's movie Us and HBO's Lovecraft Country. And there's more to come, including Peele's remake of Candyman. Robin Means Coleman is the author of Horror Noir, Blacks in American Horror Films from the 1890s to Present. She says Get Out marks a watershed moment in the history of black horror movies, similar to George Romero's 1968 Night of the Living Dead, which features a black protagonist and a racial undercurrent.
They're coming to get you, Barbara.
Stop it! You're ignorant!
They're coming for you, Barbara.
A real turning point in the way African Americans were portrayed in horror films occurred in 1968 with the release of George A. Romero's genre-defining zombie movie, Night of the Living Dead. What was so groundbreaking about Night of the Living Dead?
Night of the Living Dead, one of my favorite movies, is incredible on two fronts. The first is that Romero introduces this character, a black character named Ben. Up until this point, there had been a history in horror films where blacks were really mistreated. The blacks in horror films followed the kind of D.W. Griffith stereotyping where they were depicted as deficient and deviant. Romero doesn't do that. In fact, Ben is, he is smart, he's resourceful, he is in some ways quite the intellectual, and what we see is Ben trapped in this remote cabin, surrounded by the undead who are really trying to get them and eat them, and Ben is navigating both the horrors on the outside of this cabin, but also what is sort of horrific on the inside of the cabin, which is negotiating complex race and gender relationships.
We gotta fix these boards. You're crazy. Those things are gonna be in every window and door in this place. We've got to get down into the cellar.
Go down in that damn cellar. Get out of here!
I'm taking the girl with me.
You leave her here. Keep your hands off her. And everything else that's up here, too. Because if I stay up here, I'm fighting for everything up here. And the radio and the food is part of what I'm fighting for. Now, if you're going down the cellar, get.
Yeah, and we should point out that unlike in The Birth of a Nation, Ben is played by a black actor, a gentleman by the name of Dwayne Jones. So the ending of Night of the Living Dead is very powerful. Can you talk a bit about that?
Ben emerges. He survives the night, and he's the sole survivor of this horrific kind of zombie holocaust. And he survives all of the turmoil that's happening inside the cabin. And he emerges, and the sun is rising, and he's victorious. And then he's killed. He's not killed by zombies. He's killed by the police. He's killed by sheriffs, and in the case of Night of the Living Dead, these were real officers who were cast in the film.
Let's go check out the house, man.
There's something there. I heard a noise.
All right, Vince, hit him in the head, right between the eyes. Good shot. Okay, he's dead. Let's go get him. That's another one for the fire.
So he's killed by Pennsylvania state troopers who then do something far worse, if you can imagine that, which is to essentially burn him on a pyre. And we've seen the kinds of horrific images of slaves being burned and burned alive, and so it evokes all of those memories, and it was just such a blow, and it was real.
Yeah, and the officers in the narrative of the film, we're led to believe that the police officers who shot Ben mistook him for a zombie. Or are we?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And that's what I love about the openness of the text.
Mm-hmm.
Perhaps, you know, and I think Romero leaves that sufficiently open that perhaps they think that he's a zombie, and at the same time, perhaps, in the back of our minds, we're supposed to think that, well, police officers are fairly used to shooting first and figuring out what's happening later, and especially black men.
Yeah, and that's especially relevant these days, unfortunately. Yeah. During the credits, we see this series of still images of the handling of Ben's body, that they use hooks to take him over to a fire and burn him. You say that those look like, that the still images over the credits look like they could be the weathered photos of Emmett Till.
Lynching imagery for sure.
Let's fast forward to February 2017 and the release of Jordan Peele's Get Out. Can you give us a brief outline of the film's plot without, of course, revealing too many spoilers?
So Get Out focuses on a black male character, Chris Washington, and his girlfriend, who is white, Rose Armitage. They're taking a road trip from Brooklyn, an urban space, a very diverse space, and they're going to visit Rose's family, the Armitages, who are in a really quite white suburban space. And so this is going to be a movie about how Chris navigates this predominantly white space.
By the way, I would have voted for Obama for a third term if I could. Best president in my lifetime, hands down.
I agree, yeah.
At least that's what we think it's going to be about. Because when Chris arrives, he realizes that this is a family who is deeply involved in medicine, and ultimately he comes to realize that they're involved in medical experimentation. And so Chris is now fighting for his life in this movie.
Do you have a favorite scene in the film?
I do, and it's a subtle scene. It's not one that folks will point to. I think many audiences will point to the ending in Chris's relationship with his best friend, Rod, who is a TSA agent. But there's another scene performed by actress Betty Gabriel. She portrays Georgina. And what we know about Georgina is that she's the maid in this home. She's the black maid in this home. But if you know the plot line of Get Out, she's also something else. And so her blackness and this something else that is monstrous is trapped in a single body. And so Georgina is physically showing this battle, this internal battle that is happening. And so she is able to laugh and cry real tears at the same time.
If there's too many white people, I get nervous, you know.
Oh, no. I do something. That's not my experience. Not at all. The Armitages are so good to us. They treat us like family.
It is a heart-wrenching scene, and you know just how terrible, how awful these experiments are for black bodies.
How do you think white audiences experience Get Out versus how black audiences experienced it? I'm guessing they had to have experienced it differently.
White and black audiences alike, I think, really liked this film, if box office numbers are any indication. But the other thing that Get Out does is that it, in some ways, picks up where George Romero left off and demands that we all pay attention to our social, our political, our cultural context. And so Get Out demands that we pay attention to race relationships. It demands that we pay attention to issues such as redlining and white flight and the creation of so-called white topias, to use Rich Benjamin's language. So it's asking us to say, how far have we really come in understanding the commonalities and also the unique cultural difference between blacks and whites?
Robin Means Coleman is the author of Horror Noir, Blacks in American Horror Films from the 1890s to Present. The book was turned into a documentary by the Shudder streaming service, which specializes in horror. You can find out more about Black horror films at our website, wpr.org/beta. Well, that does it for a very scary Beta Halloween.
Oh, that's scary. Ooh.
Thanks to our guests, Joe Hill, Don Coscarelli, and Robin Means Coleman. If you want to hear it again or binge on past episodes, subscribe to the Beta Podcast via Apple Podcasts or wherever you catch your favorite pods. And make sure to let us know what you think by leaving a rating or a comment.
Listen to them, children of the night. What music they need.
You can keep up with us during the week online at wpr.org/beta.
Whatever you do, don't fall asleep.
Beta is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Red Meat Productions.
Fantastic!
Our music and technical director is Steve Gotcher.
I'm not being grouchy. I just want to finish my work.
Our executive producer, nay showrunner, is Adam Friedrich.
I realized that there was nothing within him, neither conscience nor reason, that wasn't even remotely human.
And thanks to you, our alphas. We'll see you next week. Take care and stay safe. I'm Doug Gordon.
A census taker once tried to test me. I ate his liver with some fava beans and a nice Chianti.